It's time for CPR with Aid and Assist.
Morning, Aidan.
Morning, Dan. Slightly overcast, but looks like it's going to be a potentially great day in Tamaki Makaurau.
Yep, not too bad, eh? Not too bad.
Yeah. Look, I want to do a book review, the second book I was going to look at last week, but I wanted to start with a little bit of a shout-out to the Herald, and also a bit of encouragement to people who find that some threads on the Herald begin to spiral into sort of hatred and discontent. We've talked in the past about one of the issues being mainstream organisations like the Herald, who are facing a whole new revenue model with Facebook links, etc., driving a large part of the eyeballs to their website, putting up articles which get a huge amount of attention, and therefore repeating those articles several times over the course of the weekend because it looks like a lot of people are looking at them.
Troll bait.
And part of the issue with that is it attacks some pretty repugnant trolls, and in the past we've talked about the fact that the Herald does a reasonably good job of presenting balanced coverage of events, but then basically just sort of opens the gates and for racists and homophobes to run sort of willy-nilly through their threats comments. And what happened last weekend, as many people may, if you're a league fan, you would have noticed it. If not, you would have seen it in the news. Tonga had a remarkable victory over the Kiwi League team, which, if you're not a league fan, is a huge deal. And not surprisingly, in the largest Pacific Island city on the planet, that was celebrated in South Auckland. Some of the celebrations, and only some of the celebrations, got a little bit out of hand, and there were roughly the same number of arrests as we've had at some Wellington Sevens. But the Herald ran an article, and they ran a similar article several times, talking about the troubles in South Auckland. And at one point, they actually described South Auckland being in chaos, as if it had kind of descended into mid-2000s Baghdad overnight because of a league result, which was a slight exaggeration. And anybody who was sort of speaking to people in South Auckland or had seen footage coming through other contexts in South Auckland knew that it was more than a slight exaggeration. If it had been left as a newspaper format, absolutely fine. But what happened, of course, after that is we had a whole series of people coming into the threads who were expressing points of view which weren't even questionably racist. Every now and then you're going to get a comment where you think, is that person just expressing something incautiously, or are they actually being a little bit racist? Well, these comments, there was absolutely no question whatsoever. There were comments such as...
Oh, I was going to say, don't even repeat them, Aidan.
I won't. People who saw the article know what it was, but they were clearly and overtly racist. Now, there were a lot of people responding to that, and overwhelmingly the people who were responding to those comments were basically saying, look, you're just being a little bit of a dickhead, please go away. And showing support and endorsement for people who were saying, celebrate a victory, small number of people, out of hand, no big deal. But I saw a few of these comments coming through, and so I did what we were encouraging people to do a few months ago, which is actually send a direct message to the Herald through their send a message option on the Facebook page, because a lot of these comments, which I won't repeat, a lot of these comments were clearly in violation of the terms and conditions of putting posts on the Facebook website. Within about half an hour, somebody from the Herald did get back to me. I asked for it to be acknowledged that they received my message, and about half an hour after that, they said, yep, our moderators have looked at those comments, and they have removed the offensive comments. And sure enough, I went back, and as far as I could tell at the time, the really offensive posts had been removed. So, first of all, congratulations and shout out to any Herald, anybody working at the Herald, is a VFM listener who's tuning in today. Thank you for responding so quickly and basically making sure the content stuck to terms and conditions. And secondly, to anybody listening, BFM listeners who looked at some of his comments and thought that's a bit offensive, I encourage them to consider adopting the same approach next time and actually use that direct message option. And if that doesn't work, do as I've also done in the past, which is to call the Herald, ask to speak to the digital team, express concerns about posts you see, which clearly is designed to spread hatred, and get them to get onto it. Because what I found in both occasions is they will clean it up. They've probably got a staffing issue there, like most mainstream newspapers. They may have difficulty keeping eyeballs on the threads as they keep on developing and growing at a rate of knots. But if we help them do their job, it'll de-platform some of those people who are basically there just to spread extreme bile. So, yeah, shout out to the Herald.
There's an oft-touted, just to, on that related topic, there's an oft-touted sort of statistic or fact about Tonga that people say has the highest number of PhDs per capita in the world or in the region. Do we know if that's, if that's been verified in any way, or if that's an actual, if that's a kind of a just a general sort of fact that people, that hasn't been verified? Yeah.
I don't know, but I know a couple of people through social media who will probably be happy to confirm that if it's true. So I can look into that for next week if you like.
Yeah, I was just having a look online about that because I've heard it a lot, and it's certainly plausible. You know, I've certainly met plenty of very highly educated Tongan people.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just curious where that piece of information came from in the first place.
Well, I mean, if you wanted me to, I can have a bit of a dig into that, which will consist of probably sending off a couple of tweets and we'll see what happens.
Cool, that'd be good.
Okay, cool. Look, the book I wanted to review this morning is by Mark Bray. And much like last week's book, Zoe Quinn's book, it's got a pretty bad title because it doesn't really represent what the book is actually about. The book title is Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook, which makes it sound like it's going to be a book about where to buy fashionable black scarves to hide your face and formations to go into marching positions against white supremacists. But it's actually a lot more than that and a lot more interesting than that. Mark Bray came to prominence in the United States because after the Charlottesville protests, which most people listening to BFM, I imagine, are familiar with, where you had the Unite the Right white supremacist march happening in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a protester against the march was run over and killed. It was led by Richard Spencer, etc., one of the prominent neo-Nazis in the United States. They had the famous images now of white supremacists marching with tiki torches that purchased from their local Walmarts. It was also contrasted with people who had gone there in an organized way, and they were opposing them dressed in black gear, wearing black masks or black scarves, which is what's known as a black block, which is used by Antifa and has been used for many decades, to basically protect other peaceful protesters. Now, as soon as this group started to emerge, and that emerged previously, there's a famous, the gif that rang around the world when Richard Spencer himself was punched by someone also wearing all black gear, that there was this movement called Antifa, which has flown below the radar of the mainstream media, and all of a sudden they were saying, well, who is this Antifa group, and what do they stand for, and are they an organization, a movement, etc.? And so they contacted this guy, Mark Bray. And the reason they contacted him is he works out at Dartmouth College in the States, but he is a historian who specializes in human rights, terrorism, and political extremism in Europe. So his credentials are academically taking a look at the rise of extremist groups, but he's also an activist who was involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. So he's got sort of boots on the ground experience with social organizing. And he was being interviewed by a number of organizations and media outlets, including the Washington Post, to try and put a face to Antifa to try and explain what this counter-white supremacist movement is actually about. The book is a product of that, and the book is part of a process which actually saw the university he works for discipline him for not coming out strongly enough against what they saw was Antifa's violent approach. So the book is about the movement against fascism, both in a contemporary setting and a historical setting.
Can you just give us the title one more time, please, Aidan?
Yeah, it's Antifa, A-N-T-I-F-A, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And the thing about Mark Bray is, apart from having the sort of the academic credibility of an historian, and certainly the number of footnotes speaks to that, he's a really compelling writer. And the first half of the book is actually dedicated to the historical struggle against fascism. So if you are interested in learning about the resistance against Mussolini, the resistance against Hitler before the Nazis rose to power, what was going on during the Spanish Civil War as far as global organizations trying to stop the fascist takeover, you're going to find this book absolutely fascinating. But he also goes to countries where fascism didn't succeed in taking over, but merely existed as a force to intimidate groups such as Jews, such as immigrants, such as refugees, you know, much the same way that the white supremacist movement is operating in the States now. In particular, he goes to the UK. And what's interesting about this is he goes to the UK and he takes a look at Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists, who had thousands of members before the Nazis started World War II. And he takes a look at a battle, it's called the Battle of Cable Street, which happened in 1936. And thousands of union members, socialist, communist, Jewish groups, united to stop a march by Oswald Mosley's fascist group to go through. And it was a provocative march and trying to intimidate the Jewish population, who at this stage had already experienced extreme discrimination in Germany by 1936. They were going to march for an area of South London which was predominantly Jewish, carrying banners which were sort of pro-Nazi party and anti-Semitic. And rather than meet them by holding out pamphlets, what makes Antifa different to a lot of protest groups was their commitment to meeting force with force. So rather than meeting them with chants, they met them with bricks and bats and chased them out of a neighbourhood and shattered the ability of Mosley to organise a similar march for years to come. Because volunteers weren't too keen to turn out to a march which is actually going to be resisted. And it was the broad unity which really made that movement hold together in the UK. And it's kind of like a model, Bray suggests, could work in terms of shutting down smaller groups before they become a larger threat.
Have we seen anything like that here?
No, I mean, I think one thing we've talked about here, both on air and off air, is the fact that New Zealand, for a whole lot of economic characteristics and a whole lot of the ethnic and ethnography characteristics, has not been amenable so far to a really politically significant white supremacist group.
The closest thing to what you're describing, I think that would map onto, would be the Springbok protests, right? The Springbok tour protests.
Yeah, although even then, a lot of the people who supported the Springbok tour couldn't in any way be described as racist, so they just weren't applying their understanding of racism to the existence of a tour.
But in terms of the violent reaction, I suppose that was more directed against police in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, absolutely. And again, look, there were discussions at the time, and one of the things which Mark Bray takes a look at, it's got kind of in the second part of the book, is to argue that the historical use of force to resist fascism, and there's a genuine argument about whether that's justified or not, the second half of the book deals with that specifically. It deals with issues such as, is force and violence justified to deal with force and violence, or does it decredit the anti-fascist movement? Is it okay at the University of Berkeley if someone like an Ann Coulter, if someone like a Milo Yiannopoulos, if someone like a Richard Spencer wants to speak at the university, can we justify using their pit to shut down what they allege is their freedom of expression? Do we not become closer to their methodology than the methods of a society we proclaim to stand for? And he's definitely partisan on this, which should be fairly obvious in my introduction to who he is. But the second half of the book, for anyone who's taking a look at Trump's America Now and sees groups using those methods of shutting down discussion, deplatforming it's called essentially, to stop white supremacist or far-right groups even having a public platform and have qualms about it or concerns about it or wonder about whether it's appropriate or going too far, can I recommend this book? Because he switches from being a history writer to being almost a journalist activist, covering what's going on now and presenting a series of really well-written and with great clarity, a series of talking points around why he believes the movement still has relevance today. So for me, the book sits well in one of two camps. If you are interested in history and you're interested in the historical struggle against fascism, it's a remarkably compelling account. You know, he goes into, for example, the music scene in the 1980s and the 1970s and 80s in the UK and the punk movement, some bands like Screwdriver being involved in a punk movement but clearly with a racist neo-Nazi agenda, and the rise of Rise Against Racism. So he talks about the music scene and the dynamics in that. So if you're interested in the sort of the Nazi punks, if you're a Dead Kennedys fan, you'll know the song I'm referring to. The whole music scene and how that played out in bars and clubs and venues right across North America and through the UK and through Europe, this is a book well worth having a look at, even if you're flicking through the chapters to take a look at the 70s and 80s. So I think it's one of those books, given how quickly he wrote it, and he wrote it in response to the rising interest course of Antifa activity recently, it covers the history side in a compelling and fascinating way. It covers the movement up until recently, particularly 70s, 80s, 90s, taking a look at the rise of the right, which has been a trend he's seen, he describes as slowly unfolding, and the response in music, and the response on the streets, and the response in community solidarity organisations. And he answers a lot of those debate point questions about the anti-fascist methods now justified, given the fact that, broadly speaking, the white rights movement has actually got a very, very small level of support in broader society.
Well, so, what do you reckon, Aidan? Would you hurl a Molotov into the mix?
I'm scared of fire, so probably not. But one of the things he does point out is that the movement against, in fact, the expression he uses, fascism a weapon is fear, anti-fascist movement is solidarity. There should be a place for anybody in your community, somebody who is basically disabled and unable to hurl a Molotov cocktail should still be able to turn up to a community centre or to a community organisation and find there is a place for them, because as he argues, essentially, fascism is the one ideology historians shouldn't have to be objective about when it comes to discussing it because of the nature of fascism, and anybody who wants to take a stand against fascism should be able to find a place in that community. So he's not suggesting at all that people should all be forced to go out and wear black scarves to show their level of commitment. He speaks about what he calls legitimate concerns about sort of macho bravado, which he says doesn't make us too different from a fascist, if that's what we resort to. We have to be very careful about not slipping into conflict for conflict's sake, be intelligent about strategies and tactics, but be aware that some strategies some people may feel are not particularly appropriate have been really effective in the past in shutting down the ability for fascist organisations to organise and become a really significant threat to our communities. So I personally would not feel comfortable both philosophically and in terms of my own physical safety either advocating or using force. It's not really something I feel I'm able to do.
Aidan, just a query from a listener about the link between anti-fascism and communism. So Antifa being a communist organisation, is that the case?
Yeah, look, listener, thank you for the call. Actually, a brilliant call. Well, not necessarily. And one of the things I really suggest if a listener's asking me a question, which is a fantastic question, they do go back and maybe check out the book from the library. He actually talks about how one of the difficulties at times with organising Antifa is Antifa is not necessarily communist. And in fact, in the past, organising anti-fascist movement, which he basically says is anybody who looks at fascism and says, we disagree with your ideology. So there would have been members of a Jewish community in 1936 in Cable Street, London, who in no way, shape or form would describe themselves as communists, but they could see an existential threat to their community's existence, potentially marching through their community. He does talk, in fact, about the Soviet Union at times, because of internal politics, turning around and saying, communists can work with communists, but not anarchists. Communists can work with communists, but not democratic socialists, and making it harder to organize the front. So he's not posing a, you must subscribe to a particular political point of view, to be anti-fascist, and he describes fascist basically as, you know, it's Antifa as an ideology, an identity, and a movement of self-defense, intentionally broad because it encompasses a wide range of leftist groups. So no, you don't have to have your card punched recently from your sort of local Communist Party office. And in fact, he does point out that at times, rigid ideological restrictions have made it harder to organize against the threat to the community. If you're asking me a question, have a read of it. Even if you're not really that interested in what's going on in Trump's America now, read the first half. Fascinating historical account. And if you are a journalist or just someone curious trying to understand behind the Antifa headlines, Fox News recently had a petition they delivered to the White House trying to have Antifa organized, credited as a, or registered as a terrorist group, which got shut down quickly. You know, so they're going to be in the headlines. And if you see that name in print and you think, I wish I knew a little bit more about that, can I recommend Mark Bray's book? Because it will answer a lot of those questions.
That title one more time, Aidan?
Yeah, okay, so it's Mark Bray, B-R-A-Y, and the book is Antifa, A-N-T-I-F-A, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. And like I've said, it is much more than a handbook. It's a thoroughly gripping and compelling history of a movement against fascism.
Hey, have a wonderful Saturday. We have got Dollar Disco up next. Catch you later,
wait.
Aidan.
Okay.
Thank you.
See you then. Bye.
That was CPR with Aidan Assist.
We'll just sneak in.